This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. Back to that idea now that Bethany McLean and I ended with, this thing that has come to be called shareholder value. Companies like Valiant, as we were talking about, jumping through hoops to maximize profits and give money back to shareholders. Shareholders that sometimes, yes, are directly mom-and-pop investors, but increasingly are hedge funds and Wall Street insiders. And the thing is that corporations have made conscious decisions to change their priorities to make profits their most important product. So to begin our week-long series about shareholder value, we're calling it The Price of Profits, this question. What are corporations for? Why are they in business? Dan Bobkoff, an editor with our partner on this project, Business Insider, starts things off.
For those of us feeling insecure about our jobs and our futures, the story I'm about to tell may sound like a fairy tale. Imagine for a moment an employer that takes care of you from cradle to grave, one that hosts lavish carnivals for your family, a place where workers feel intensely loyal because they're treated so well. That company was IBM.
In the middle of the 20th century, it was the most famous, the most admired, and the most widely respected company in the world.
Quinn Mills is professor emeritus at Harvard Business School and wrote books about IBM and its culture. There were even company-owned country clubs where any employee, executive, or factory worker could play and golf for pennies. You can still find retired IBMers like Ron Diedrich grumbling on the green at one of them in Poughkeepsie.
Yeah, he used to play for nothing. Now it costs me like $3,000 a year.
IBM sold the course in the 90s. It was just one hit to what had been an IBM core value, what it called respect for the individual. If you got in, they'd take care of you in a big way, says Professor Mills.
What that meant in IBM was that people were not laid off for lack of work. When IBM's business turned down, the company found other ways to employ, to use its people.
It's true. From its early days in the 1920s, through the Depression, wars, the oil crisis, you name it, IBM went more than seven decades without a layoff. Mills says the company's founder, Thomas Watson, called it full employment.
He believed that people worked better when they were secure, not insecure. He believed that people would make a full commitment to the company if they knew that they could count on the company to make a full commitment to them.
Most companies weren't that generous. IBM was the most extreme example of a big business norm in the middle of the 20th century, a norm very different than today's. Richard Silla is an economic historian at NYU.
Most corporate executives in this period when prosperity was widely shared thought, you know, that's, we can make a profit and we can take care of the workers and we want to make good profits for the products for the customers and we want to be fair to our suppliers and we want to be good citizens of the community.
Thomas Watson Jr. absolutely believed that. As the son of IBM's founder and its post-war CEO, he gave a series of speeches in the 1960s outlining the IBM values he and his father developed. As businessmen, he said, we think in terms of profits, but people continue to rank first. Years later, that would change at IBM and most big companies. But before we get there, I didn't call an economic historian for nothing. So let's review the history of the corporation, which for our purposes begins with railroads in the late 1800s. They created the first mass market in the world, coast to coast. That market allowed companies to build large, efficient, centralized factories. And with them came the first tycoons.
The corporations that were most efficient, like Rockefeller and Carnegie, Rockefeller in oil, Carnegie in steel, they grew to be very large corporations, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so America then had big business.
At their most basic level, corporations allow a group of people to put their money together. They can then grow by reinvesting their own profits and also issue stocks and bonds, growing much faster than if they had to raise and use their own cash. And so we start to get electricity and automobiles and radio, and the public starts pouring cash into the stock market. Then you know what happened next. Stock market crash, depression, New Deal, and with the New Deal came new regulations. Now companies were forced to reveal a lot of information to investors.
Wall Street hated it at the time, but not long after World War II, they realized it was probably the best thing that ever happened to them when the public, because of the New Deal regulations, had a great new confidence in Wall Street, and Wall Street boomed pretty much in the 1950s and 60s.
American companies had little competition. Most of their rivals in Europe and Japan were rebuilding after World War II's destruction.
during those two decades, I was a young man then, 1945 to 1965, American corporations pretty much had the world to themselves. Everybody was happy. You know, when we compare that time with today, we find that everybody seemed to share in the prosperity, from the corporate executives right down to the production line workers.
There was a lot of work to be done, so companies paid well, and with IBM in the lead, started to offer benefits like pensions and health care. Professor Mills of Harvard.
The notion was that there were three sources of power in the society. There was the government, of course, there was business, and there were the unions or labor. And that those three elements of the society would work together to manage its economy and its society, etc.
More companies started to look like IBM. For IBM itself, Watson Jr. was making big bets, shifting the company from mechanical tabulating devices to this new thing called a computer.
System 360, the beginning of a new age.
It paid off. Its hundreds of thousands of workers brought us into the modern computer age, leasing and servicing IBM's room-sized mainframes to companies around the world.
System 360 has the terminals.
But while IBM powered ahead, the rest of the corporate economy was running into problems. Richard Silla.
The 70s were overall a kind of decade of great problems for the U.S.
Lots of things happened at once. Spending on the Vietnam War and the war on poverty led to inflation. That made it more expensive for American companies to do business at the very moment Japan and Germany were ready to compete.
Corporations were kind of squeezed, so American corporations began to rethink their whole models.
They shifted focus almost entirely to their bottom lines.
Forget about the workers. Build your factory in Mexico or someplace else where labor's cheaper.
And so that's the history. At IBM, just as it had been ahead in taking care of workers, it took longer to abandon that value. It took a crisis. In the 80s, management tried to protect the mainframe business against new competition from PCs. It didn't work. In the early 90s, IBM was running out of cash. Then, IBM hired its first outsider to lead the company, Louis Gerstner.
That's when IBM got a big dose of shareholder value.
One morning early on, Thomas Watson Jr. sat in the back of the car that drove Gerstner to the office. Gerstner says Watson told him to take whatever steps necessary to get the company back on track. But in many ways, the steps Gerstner took were a repudiation of the values Watson outlined in the 60s. In a speech, Gerstner said what IBM needed was, quote, a series of very tough-minded market-driven strategies. Strategies, he said, that deliver performance in the marketplace and shareholder value. IBM then, in 1993, did the unthinkable, a layoff. 60,000 workers had to go.
Basically, it was, look to the left, look to the right. Some of you won't be here. I think that's when my heart went through the floor.
Marcy Holly was on IBM's communications team and among those who had to tell the world about the layoffs.
Productivity, I really feel, decreased because people were looking for jobs. People were standing in the hallways talking about, who they thought would get laid off.
Gerstner said, in effect, that IBM needed to look more like its peers. That meant also cutting back pensions and fewer perks, like those golf courses where Ron Diedrich plays.
So many things have changed. Just seem to be out of control.
How so?
Well, I don't know. In the past, you got rewarded for good work.
Many accounts credit Gerstner with saving IBM and moving it into services. More recently, some critics contend IBM has moved into the financial engineering business, failing to grow revenue but generating profits with strategies such as buying back its stock. Workers like Robert Ochoa, who retired last month, say the company is not the same.
It's no longer respect for the individual. It's more respect for the stockholders.
And as we'll hear more this week, IBM is not alone. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
Our whole project, that is videos, timelines, and oh so much more, will be at priceofprofits.org. Updates, of course, coming all week.